Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we'll be talking with religious scholar Jana Reese. She gave the 2024 Arrington Mormon History Lecture at USU last week titled Latter-day Saint Women and the Quiet Erosion of Certainty. Historically, Latter-day Saint women in the U.S. have been significantly more certain in their beliefs and more actively engaged in the church than their male counterparts. However, Reese says that findings from the latest Next Mormon survey reveal that this gender advantage in religious certainty has diminished, and she discusses how this change affects women's perceptions of their spiritual lives and their roles within the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Jana Reese is a senior columnist for Religion News Service and a prominent contributor to the Salt Lake Tribune. She'll join us following the news. Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to be talking with religious scholar Jana Reese. She gave the 2024 Arrington Mormon History Lecture at Utah State University last week, titled Latter-day Saint Women and the Quiet Erosion of Certainty. Historically, Latter-day Saint women in the U.S. have been significantly more certain in their beliefs and more actively engaged in the church than their male counterparts. However, Reese says that findings from the 2022-2023 Next Mormons survey reveal that this gender advantage and religious certainty has diminished. She discusses how this change affects women's perceptions of their spiritual lives and their roles within the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Jana Reese is a senior columnist for the Religion News Service and a prominent contributor to the Salt Lake Tribune. Her notable works include The Next Mormons, How Millennials Are Changing the LDS Church, and the comedic memoir Flunking Sainthood. Reese holds a doctorate in American religious history from Columbia University and a master's in divinity degree from Princeton Theological Seminary. Jana Reese came to our UPR studios for this conversation the day before giving the Arrington Mormon History Lecture last week. Here's part one of our conversation. The subject matter of the Arrington Mormon History Lecture will, I believe, be taken from the latest Next Mormons survey. So we thought it might be good to go back to the first one, kind of set the level and kind of the top line. So first of all, what were you trying to do with that survey, which is what, 2016?
Yes, that survey was in 2016. And we're now calling it the NMS-1, that there is an NMS-2, although that doesn't quite roll off the tongue, does it? So the first one was primarily looking at generational difference among current and former Latter-day Saints. And the book that came out of that was published in 2019, and it was called The Next Mormons, How Millennials Are Changing the LDS Church. So we were looking, and by we, I mean my quantitative research partner, Benjamin Knoll, who is a political scientist. My training is as a historian. So I do primarily the oral history component of all of the interviews with people and then the writing of the book, but I'm not the quantitative scientist there. So in that book, in The Next Mormons, we were chronicling in a sort of microcosm what we were seeing in religion in America more generally, which is that younger adults in the United States tend to be less religious than people who were over 60 in particular. So why is that? And then how does it manifest itself among Latter-day Saints, basically?
So this was kind of new, isn't it? The kind of questions you were asking. There are kind of famous general religious studies over many denominations. This one you're focusing specifically on Latter-day Saints.
Right,
and
at that
millennials.
Time. Yes, at the time, it was, I believe, the largest nationally representative survey of Latter-day Saints. It has since been surpassed, which is great. That's what we want to see. We want to see a lot of researchers in this space because it just enriches everything about what we know about this people.
Yeah. So what are some of the top line findings from that 2016 survey?
So in the 2016 NMS, essentially, the nutshell version is that millennials were not as religious as their parents and grandparents in the LDS Church, but significantly more religious than their peers in their generation in the United States as a whole, which is a tension for many of them. You know, they are kind of caught between this sort of orthodoxy of their older, the older Latter-day Saints, their parents, their grandparents, and they love parts of that. But on the other hand, their generation looks very different in the things that it values, the pop culture that it enjoys, and most importantly, how much less salient religion is for that generation than it had been 50 to 70 years before in American life.
Does this track the broader culture, other denominations, other religions?
It definitely tracks. I would say that what's happening now with Latter-day Saints in the United States already happened with mainline Protestantism and with Catholicism to a certain extent. It is also now happening with evangelical Protestantism or conservative Protestantism. But the secularization process is not necessarily an even process in terms of who is affected and to what extent they are affected, where those people live, how saturated they are in their religious community. Meaning, like if you're a Latter-day Saint and you live in Salt Lake City, you are more saturated with other Latter-day Saints. It's in the school that your kids go to. It's in possibly the workplace that you go to every day. Where I live in Cincinnati, Ohio, other than church, my Latter-day Saint identity doesn't really intersect with my other identities on a daily basis unless I make a point of doing that, right? But it's a lot easier to have your values, I suppose, reinforced when you live in an area that is surrounded by people who believe and practice the way you do.
So these now going to NMS, trying to pick
yes,
up the parlance.
Yes, that's
correct. NMS 2.
Yes.
Are these trends accelerating, staying level, reversing?
That's a great question. So generationally, millennials have continued along the same track that we were observing. We're not finished analyzing our data, so I hesitate to put this out in the world. But so far, in general, it looks like millennials and Gen Xers are still secularizing a bit more. Generation Z, though, which is the youngest generation of adults, we need to be careful because we had fewer than 200 Generation Z members within the survey, so you want to be careful about any conclusions that you draw. But the general overview top-line finding is that they are often more religious than millennials and Gen Xers. Before people go jumping for joy about that finding and saying, aha, this is evidence that the secularization process is reversing. The more likely scenario, and this is based on research in other religious populations and also even within our own data set, the more likely scenario is that it has already started self-sorting and that the median age for Generation Z who had left the church in our sample was lower than it had been for other people who had left the church as adolescents, right? So the people are already maybe leaving the church and are outside the current sample of Latter-day Saints who say that they're still involved. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's a bit of a self-selection bias in there.
Right. I want to kind of go get you to do kind of a, more top level, I guess, theorizing about why these trends, both in the NMS-1 and NMS-2, with the caveat that you haven't sorted through all of the NMS-2 stuff.
Absolutely have not sorted through all of it. In fact, I'm not sure we will ever be able to untangle everything because it's a pretty long and involved survey, which is, wonderful, but it takes a lot of time. But in terms of your question, in broad strokes, there are a lot of theories about why people are leaving religion. Just to give a bit of historical analysis here, we really didn't see a lot of movement in the non-religious population until the 1990s. And then in the early to mid-1990s, there suddenly starts to be people moving into this area, particularly young adults identifying as non-religious. And there is a cottage industry of social scientists who try to pinpoint what was going on in the United States at that time. Was it simply that the U.S. was on a later trajectory, for example, than Western Europe, which had already secularized in the 1960s and 1970s? Possibly. Was it because, and I know this is going to sound nuts, but was it because of the fall of communism in the late 1980s? There is a sociological theory, for example, that Americans were very united for a long time around this identity of being anti-communist, which was very tied up in religion because those people were the godless people. And if we're going to be different from those people, then we are by default religious. And so when that falls apart, suddenly there isn't necessarily that enemy against whom you define yourselves. So that's another theory. There are so many theories. Another is the contract with America. So essentially the rise of very conservative, quote, family values, unquote, politics in the 1990s was a real turnoff for a lot of people. So there's probably a grain of truth in all of these theories, but the largest, overarching, most timeless theory is that when, and boy, this is so much present in the Book of Mormon, right? When a society begins to do well and people are existentially secure, they know where their next meal is coming from, they have some security, suddenly they don't need religion anymore to the extent that they needed it when everything was so tenuous and they had to rely upon each other. They had nothing else to rely upon and prayer. So that is the timeless story about what's happening, essentially that the United States is a victim of its own success in terms of its tremendous economic growth in the 20th century.
So I was looking at an article here about your book. So the survey, right, NMS1, then a book, The Next Mormons, which I think hit, did fairly well. Now, I love the headline here of your one of your recent columns, Why I've Been AWOL from your column. It's because you're writing another book, right, based on the NMS2, I guess. By the way, you say this is your least favorite part of your job is writing.
Yes, which is ironic, right? You know, I don't know what that says about my levels of self-loathing that this task that I don't necessarily enjoy at all is probably 70% of my work life.
Right, right. Well, you're fascinated by the doing the surveys and,
yes,
and finding
the research.
Finding out the research.
And the interviews with people. It's amazing how, you know, just how open and honest people have been in the oral history interviews and in really inviting me into their lives, sometimes with a lot of emotion. You know, their decisions to either stay or to leave the church are wrapped up in so many other things. Their family history, not wanting to disappoint parents or children or siblings, friends. There's a lot of turmoil sometimes for people who are leaving the church or just thinking about it.
Yeah. I want to get to that just a moment because that is a very poignant, important thing to talk to those people. But I was struck by some of the findings here of the NMS1. Belief and doubt that Jesus Christ was literally resurrected from the dead. And that changes by generation. Boomer generation, I'm confident, know this is true, 83%. By the time you get to millennials, that's down to 57%.
Well, spoiler alert, we're seeing some more of the same in terms of you know, the overall sample. And there is this phenomenon called cohort replacement, which is essentially, not to put too fine a point on it, young people aging into surveys, becoming adults, becoming eligible to take surveys, and older people either no longer being interested in taking surveys or passing away. And so in the 6 to 7 years since we did the 2016 NMS and then the 2022 and 2023 follow-up surveys, we have, you know, lost some of the older population. So as a result of that, you know, you do see a little bit of movement to the left.
I guess this is part of that secularization that's happening, right?
Yes.
Maybe I believe in divinity, but I don't believe in the literal resurrection of Jesus Christ.
Definitely kind of we're seeing some drops in certainty, particularly among women.
Predicted by Women, yeah. I want to get to that as well. Just this kind of one of the top line things from, so the Latter-day Saints who are troubled by the church's emphasis on conformity and obedience by generation. So boomers, 12%, find it very troubling. Gen X, 19%. And by the time you get to millennials, 26%. This is from the NMS one.
Right. So it's still a minority who choose that, who select that as something that is problematic for them, but it is interesting to see how it is different from one generation to the next. Millennials, you know, have grown up in a very different society, and Generation Z all the more so, where you go to Chipotle and you design every aspect of your meal, right? You are going to choose your meat and you're going to choose your vegetables. And in my case, I don't eat cilantro, so, you know, I have to have the other rice, right? That's what we're used to, and that's what they have grown up with. It's a very different world than, you know, my parents, for example. Certainly my grandparents was, you get what you get and you don't throw a fit, right? Religiously, there has been some tension within the church where LDS leaders have cautioned against what they are calling cafeteria spirituality, or the idea that you can simply order up some parts of a religion from a menu and then ignore the other parts. The reality, of course, is that we all do cafeteria religion all the time, just by choosing which parts of Scripture we're going to emphasize and which parts we're going to conveniently ignore. I mean, I'm sitting here in a shirt that is mixed fibers, which is explicitly forbidden, right, by the Old Testament. But I choose to ignore that because I'm practicing cafeteria religion. We do it all the time. But for millennials and for Gen Z, that idea of individual choice, of autonomy, of personal freedom, that has been taught to them all their lives everywhere else in this culture, except sometimes not the church. So that creates a lot of tension.
What about LGBTQ issues? You looked into that in NMS1. I'm not sure about NMS2, but yeah. Of course, this trend has been moving in the society at large, also, I think, among Latter-day Saints.
Yes, definitely. It is not just happening within the LDS bubble. It is everywhere. And we're certainly seeing that trend continue, not only in the attitudes of people within the church toward LGBTQ issues, but also simply the rising percentage of people within the church and outside the church who identify as LGBTQ+, especially among the younger generations.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with religious scholar Jana Reese. She gave the 2024 Arrington Mormon History Lecture at USU last week. The title of the talk was Latter-day Saint Women and the Quiet Erosion of Certainty. We're talking about that and related topics with her. Recorded this interview last week when Jana Reese was in town. We'll have more following this. Our guest for the hour today is religious scholar Jana Reese. She gave the latest Arrington Mormon History Lecture at USU last week. The title of the talk, Latter-day Saint Women and the Quiet Erosion of Certainty. Jana Reese is senior columnist for Religion News Service and a prominent contributor to the Salt Lake Tribune. And she talked with us at our UPR studios the day before giving that lecture last week. Here's part two of the conversation. The subject of your talk, the Arrington Mormon History Lecture, will be about women, and the title is Latter-day Saint Women and the Quiet Erosion of Certainty. So maybe we could start at certainty. Was that the Latter-day Saint women more certain about about the religion than men in the past? And I guess that's eroding.
Well, so as an example, Ben and I co-wrote an article for an academic anthology summarizing some of the research about women and essentially saying that in terms of belief certainty, the people who choose the top option on a scale, the one that says I'm confident and know this is true and not merely I believe this is true, women had an average of a 9-point advantage over LDS men in that kind of certainty. And so the upshot of some of the differences we're seeing here is that women are still very strong believers, particularly when compared to the rest of American culture. Latter-day Saints or Mormons in America are some of the most religious people in America, right, in a time of rapidly declining religiosity. But they are also affected by what's going on around them. And so for women, we're seeing some movement out of that top category and maybe into the second category, I believe and have faith this is true, or I think this might be true, but I have doubts.
And I guess you're finding shifts over time.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, that 9-point advantage that I was talking about, women and men now in this data set look much like each other. They are resembling each other much more closely than they did when there was a significant gender gap in our previous data.
Mm. Do you have theories about why?
I have theories, yes. I do have some theories. The biggest thing to recognize is that this is part of a much larger shift that's happening among women in American culture. I don't know if you've been following any of those headlines this year, but for example, mm-hmm. in April, there was a research study that indicated for the first time, young women were more likely than young men to leave religion altogether. And there have been a couple of follow-up analyses of other data that have confirmed that finding. And that's really interesting. So for a long time, the stereotype was that men were more likely to leave religion if anyone was going to leave religion. And women were holding steady, hearth and home, keeping those religious fires burning. And then right around the millennials, the gender gap began to disappear, where you see parity in who is leaving religion, or closer to parity. And then with Generation Z, this is the first time in survey history, essentially, that we've seen the reversal of that gender pattern.
Hmm. So shrinking gender gap in religion, vastly increasing one politically. That's another
They're subject. Related, yeah. though.
Are they related?
They are
really?
Very much related. Yes. Actually, if I could recommend a book, The Politics of Generation Z by Melissa Deckman, that she's from Public Religion Research Institute, and the book just came out maybe last month. And I interviewed her for Religion News Service about this intersection between politics and religion. You know, young women look sometimes at what's going on with very conservative politics and how that is tied to religion. And they have been raised, as I mentioned, in this environment that emphasizes a lot of personal autonomy, a lot of personal decision making, no limitations on what they can do with their lives. And they look at what this group of conservative Christians wants to impose nationally, and they say, not only do I not want that politically, I don't want to have anything to do with that religiously either, right? So there is a bit of a backlash effect in what we're seeing with young women. In fact, in one of the studies, it's really interesting that the crossover date is 2016 when you see young – yeah, it's not just in one survey, but it's very symbolic, isn't it, that this is when young women become more likely to leave religion than young men.
Obviously, that's the rise of President Trump. you're talking about broader trends. A figure like Donald Trump maybe exacerbates that?
Yes, right. The trends were happening mm-hmm. already, and they were underway, but that is a catalyst. That is one of those moments in time. I think for many women in general, but younger women perhaps in particular, it was quite bewildering to have people they loved and trusted vote for someone who admitted on tape to sexually assaulting women. You know, and for example, in a conservative Protestant or Latter-day Saint environment where women are growing up in a culture that encourages the protection of women, you know, this is the bargain of patriarchy. If you are going to be in a patriarchal system as a woman, you surrender certain things in terms of your autonomy to make choices or to lead organizations in exchange for that protection. And so when the protection is not forthcoming, that's a wake-up call.
So you, in addition to the survey, you conduct a lot of interviews, right? And it's mostly people leaving the church. We're talking about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Yeah, so this time around it is groups that are, I'm calling liminals and leavers. Leavers, obviously, are people who no longer consider themselves to be LDS, whether they've taken their names off the rolls or not. That seems to be a minority of people who take that formal step. And then the other group, liminals, are people who are still identifying as members of the church, but who have either undergone a faith transition or a faith crisis, or who simply were never, quote, all in, unquote, to begin with. And there are a surprising number of those people.
I imagine these conversations are, pretty poignant.
Yeah.
What are kind of some memorable things or some top line, I don't want to call it data, but some things that you could tell us about, about folks you've talked to?
Well, I don't use the qualitative interviews as quantitative data. There are social scientists who do that. But for me, this is a way of understanding what questions I should be asking of the research and just putting a human face on the story. You know, these are people's lives. These are people's families. Some of the things that stick with me primarily are the stories of family relationships and how those are really stressed and challenged when someone has a faith crisis in the family. And the good news from the data is that most families do seem to recover, and most people who leave the church, even the ones who say that they were not happy at the time when they were leaving the church, report happiness and peace now. So the good news is it does get better, but sometimes for many people, especially those who were all in, who did grow up in the church and who fulfilled the milestones that the church expects for early adulthood, it's so hard. It's so much harder than for the people who leave when they're in early adolescence, for example, and they haven't started a family and raised their own kids in this religious tradition that they have so much love for. And also, it's very fraught. They have a lot of pain that's associated with it as well.
Why do you think that is more painful for those who have fulfilled those expectations? You're probably talking about religious mission.
Yeah.
Getting married in the temple, that sort of thing.
Right, right. Well, because for the people who, and this is actually not the majority of leavers, because most people do leave in late adolescence or very early adulthood. In our previous survey, it was like 80% of people left before age 25, which is not necessarily the narrative that you hear if you're on social media of former Mormon websites, which have, been very helpful for a lot of people. But most of the people who gravitate to those are well into adulthood, and they have a lot of unpacking to do. People who tend to leave earlier have far less unpacking to do because they didn't have those milestones. They hadn't gone to the temple, for example, and they hadn't served the mission. They hadn't gotten married in the faith. And there are just fewer things that they have to sort through or reconstruct.
Mm-hmm. I imagine there are as many stories as there are people you've interviewed, but do people tend to, couples tend to leave together, one leave and the other not?
I imagine
there could be some tensions there in a such family.
Those are the stories that I think are the most tense and poignant when couples don't agree. It does seem actually that most couples do agree, and families, and I'm sure that the church would not be happy to hear this, but that when one person leaves the church, it does tend to have a domino effect on other people. It's hard. I mean, especially if you're a family who are living in the same house and you have all of these daily decisions that you have to negotiate. Is there going to be a coffee maker on the counter? And are we going to, what are we going to do on Sundays? What is it appropriate to tell our kids about the faith crisis that mom or dad is having? All of these things have to be negotiated, and that's really stressful. Also, I think that some of the people that I've interviewed have talked about not getting what they were promised. I think that there was a sort of emphasis on a transactional kind of theology, that if you do the following things, if you have the family home evening, your kids are going to be great. They're not going to leave the church. If you go to church every Sunday and you have family prayer every day, your kids are never going to leave the church. You have built that foundation. And actually, sociologically, they are far less likely to leave if you do those things. That's totally true. But there was never a guarantee that that was going to be the case. And when you're living in a culture where 40% of people their age are leaving religion, right, it's way harder to say just the things that we do inside this house are going to be enough to have a particular outcome. So some of the people that I've interviewed, particularly women, have bemoaned this sense of, I put all my eggs in this basket, right? That my children were going to be fine, and because we worked so hard for that goal of having them all be married in the temple, for example. We kind of forgot that they've got their agency, right? And it's acutely painful. But some of the most hopeful stories that people have told me have been about the recovery of those relationships, about parents just deciding that my relationship with my adult child or my teenager who is leaving the church or having a faith crisis, the relationship is so much more important than their status in the church. For husbands and wives, it's a little bit different because many people, you know, grew up, for example, in a young women personal progress program or a young man hearing this particular lesson about the qualities that you're supposed to look for in your eternal companion. And that kind of ideology about how you look for a spouse was very role-based. So you're looking for, if you're a young woman, you're looking for the man who can take you to the temple. You're looking for the return missionary. You're looking for the guy who's going to be able to give a priesthood blessing on the first day of school every year. And if you're a man, you're looking for this righteous mother who's going to be able to raise your children lovingly and, you know, all of the things, cook funeral potatoes, all of the things, right? Or make General Conference cinnamon rolls. My point is, though, that if you have that primarily as your goal in finding a lifelong or eternal companion, and that person changes and the role changes, if the role is all you had to go on, that's when the marriage is in trouble.
Yeah, and when you go into a marriage, there's kind of a contract, right? There's kind of an agreement. This is how our life is going to go. And then when that changes,
yes,
especially if it changes only for one and not the other, I could see where that could be quite painful. How have people navigated that? Have you seen success stories where people, the divided household, have navigated that successfully?
Well, the happiest families seem to be the ones who are able to talk about it more openly. The saddest stories that I have heard have been the ones where they either don't talk about it because everyone is terrified of offending someone, or they have the conversation one time, like the adult child says, Mom, Dad, I'm stepping away from the church. And then they are shocked and they sit there and they try to process this and nobody ever brings it up again. And that is surprisingly common, how people might have the conversation once and then not talk about it again. The families, though, that seem to thrive are the ones that find other things to base their relationship on. One of the common things that people who have left the church will say is how frustrating it is that at every family reunion, the conversation is about what a church leader has just said or who is just returning from a mission and is on fire for the gospel, you know, because it's a very religiously saturated culture, which, you know, sociologically is a great thing. But if you've left that culture, it's so hard to have that be the topic of every conversation. So the families that have really succeeded well are the ones that can acknowledge, wow, we have a difference now, and we're going to prioritize our relationship over that difference, but we're not going to ignore the difference. We're going to talk about it. Like one family, the woman was sending this talk about, this was from a long time ago. The church does not teach this anymore, but there was a time when the church taught, when a family member leaves the church, you should probably shun that person. And if they come home, for example, for a visit, maybe they shouldn't be staying in your house or something along those lines. And the mother sent this to her adult child, this General Conference talk or BYU talk, I can't remember. And she included a note on it and she said, I don't believe this is true. And just that sort of opening of the very orthodox parents saying, you know what, actually, you are more important to me than your membership in a church. That was a huge thing for that family.
Why do people, I guess there's a variety of reasons, why are the top reasons people say that they're leaving the church?
Well, there was remarkable consistency across our surveys. The top two reasons, top three reasons are basically the same. And I would say also that they are the same in other surveys. I lost my belief is the number one reason. Basically, when you have lost your belief in the truth of a religion's teachings, that is consistently the most important reason to go. But another thing that has happened is, you know, I noted in the previous iteration in the NMS1 that we saw LGBTQ issues among millennials was, you know, third, I think tied for third among reasons for leaving. Now for the whole sample, everybody, that has come up a few places. Also, women's roles have come up just a couple of places. It's still not in the top five, women's roles, but LGBTQ issues is now in the top five for everybody. Number four this time was the church's position on LGBT issues, and that one was number seven in 2016.
Okay.
So it's arisen a little bit.
That has arisen a little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're talking with religious scholar Jana Reese. She was in town last week to give the 2024 Arrington Mormon History Lecture at Utah State University. We'll have more with Jana Reese following. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and we're talking with religious scholar Jana Reese today. She gave the 2024 Arrington Mormon History Lecture at USU last week, titled Latter-day Saint Women and the Quiet Erosion of Certainty. Jana Reese is a senior columnist for Religion News Service and a prominent contributor to the Salt Lake Tribune. Here's the last portion of my conversation from last week with Jana Reese. I want to move on to those liminal Latter-day Saints, people who had a faith crisis and decided to stay. And I'm wondering, you know, maybe give me, you know, some top lines of, and again, experiences probably are, you know, as varied as the people you talk to. But that's an interesting group that maybe doesn't get as much press, for example.
Yes, and I'm very glad that you said that because I really do believe this is the least studied group. And, you know, scholars have had a lot of time for Orthodox Latter-day Saints over the course of decades, which is great. We have so much good research about that community, the Loyalists. We also have a burgeoning whole group of research people who are working on people who are leaving the church and leaving other religions and looking at disaffiliation patterns more generally. But this middle group is the understudied group, and actually statistically within the church, they are the majority. So it is helpful to try to understand what they're thinking. I also think this group is important because it's very hard for the most loyal members of the church and for the leavers to talk to each other, and the liminals are in the middle. They can understand some of these reasons why people are leaving. They don't think it's crazy in the way that some of the staunchest members of the church might think it's just bananas that anyone would want to leave. But they also are still in this institution, and they love it. And they, according to our data, are often strong believers. So for them, they're still able to communicate with the most loyal members. So they are the go-between community. And I think that's very important, especially in polarized times.
Mm-hmm. So those in-betweens, the liminals, what do they tell you? Why they went through a faith crisis, but they decided to stay. Why? What are some of the reasons? How did they navigate that when others that went through a faith crisis and left?
So that's a great question, and it's a complicated one. Liminals and leavers are in some ways very similar to one another, and in other ways they're very different from one another. I would love it if all of us who are looking at patterns of why people might leave the church, if we stepped back from our narratives about individual behavior and started looking at culture, started looking at what's going on in the U.S. more generally, but also what's going on within LDS culture. And consistently, across multiple surveys, the people who are most comfortable in the church are white, they are married, they are college educated, they are heterosexual, and they are Republican. So those are your top five, right, for feeling like this church was made for you, right now, at least in this country. And if you are out of step on any one of those things, if, for example, you're bisexual or if you're a Democrat, you're starting to chip away at that sense that this church was made for you. If you have two or three or four of those categories, well, it becomes harder and harder to stay. This works in an additive fashion, essentially. And so instead of thinking about narratives like that person wanted to sin, or that person left because they were lazy and they didn't want to study the gospel. Boy, that one in particular, many of the people that I've talked to, I would say they study the gospel more than I do. You know, they are very, very well acquainted with its history and theology. Studying is not the problem, right? Lazy learning is not the problem. Culture is often the problem. And the narratives of individual decision-making, ironically, are fueling this whole larger story about secularization in which everything is dependent on individual decisions and autonomy rather than what's going on communally.
I'll just ask this on a kind of a layer. You pick what you want, but what should, you know, the church leaders, the top leaders, the local leaders, fellow members, fellow family members, how should any and all of those, deal with this?
Yeah.
So if you know somebody who's, you know, thinking about leaving and you don't want them to, or somebody who has left and, you know, you preserve that relationship. So any and all of that, I guess.
There is no one answer because, as you mentioned before, every story is pretty different. Even the ones that have similar patterns are often very different in the particulars. The very best thing that you can do, and frankly, I don't think this is something that many people are trained well to do in the context of the church, is just to listen. To ask the kinds of questions that are not yes-no questions, but what led to you making this choice? How do you feel about it? And what do you want to happen? What are your ideal outcomes of either staying or leaving? Or how have other people responded to you? There are all kinds of non-judgmental, thoughtful questions that you can ask to someone who is having a faith crisis or a faith transition without making that person feel, because they often already feel such shame, right? They often already feel plenty of judgment of themselves. You don't need to be piling on to that. And you also don't need to come in and swoop in. I think this is the part where maybe in the church culture we don't necessarily excel. You don't need to swoop in and give them an answer, right? I've talked to many people who came to their bishop or their stake president and said, oh, wow, I've just been looking at the following things, including the gospel topics essays that the church produces, and I didn't know that this had happened, or I didn't know that the church had ever taught that. What the heck do I do with this bishop? And then the bishop says, okay, let me research that and get back to you, which is so noble, right? And it's coming from such a heartful, well-intentioned, beautiful place, but it might not be what they need. Right? It's not necessarily that people always need a factual answer to a question, even if it's a seemingly answerable question, which a lot of theological things are not. It might just be that they need someone to listen to them without trying to make it all better, and just to ask those kinds of questions, like, and to say, this church is here for you if you want to be here, if this is a place that can be positive and helpful and constructive in your life, which I have to say, it can't be for everyone. I know that's going to be a controversial thing to say, but for people, particularly for sexual minorities, sometimes staying in the church is not a safe place. And so it's not one size fits all.
I was struck by a column you did. It was September of last year. This was on the anniversary of the September 6th.
Yeah.
And first of all, I know from your bio, you went to divinity school. You were going to be a Protestant minister.
That's right.
And you came out neither a Protestant nor a minister.
Yes.
You say,
that's right.
Because you had joined the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in the meantime. So you were baptized on the same day or around the same time as the September 6th. And you say the headline here is, I became a Latter-day Saint 30 years ago with both eyes open, and that has made all the difference. Mm. You can talk a little bit about that.
Yes. I mean, by the time I joined the church, I had already read a lot of the things that might be considered controversial. I didn't want to make such an important decision, not only about my religious life, but also about my career, because as you said, I was studying to be a pastor. I had my career all mapped out. I was also already married to a Protestant man. We had a plan, right? And this just upended the entire plan for me to become a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And then to do so in September of 1993, when we have such tumult in the church. At that time, or shortly before that time, Boyd K. Packer had identified the three greatest enemies of the church as feminists, LGBTQ people, and so-called intellectuals. And I was thinking, you know, I'm heterosexual, but the other two kind of fit. And how is that going to work? You know? And so for me, it was a lot of prayer. It took me months to get baptized. I mean, I started studying the missionary discussions in 1991. And it wasn't until September of 1993 that I was baptized. So that kind of tells you something, right? Mm. Not a decision that I took lightly at all. And I've never regretted it. You know, I've had beautiful experiences in my life in the LDS Church that I wouldn't have had otherwise. But I also think that there are a lot of things about the church that could change in very positive ways that would make it a more inclusive environment for more people.
So what are some things, what are some suggestions that the church as a whole could do, as you were saying?
Thankfully, it is not my job to come up with constructive ideas about how to change the church publicly. I have certainly expressed those privately to the people that I'm close to, but I don't really feel comfortable, if you don't mind, saying that on the radio.
Totally understand. Before we close, we're just about out of time here. You had an article April of this year about growth. Mm. So, you know, the statistics come out every year. I guess around April conference time, right? So that's the headline here, the positives and negatives of LDS church growth. And you say in this article there are two scenarios. So if you want to pick holes of this and say, you know, the negative view against the church, look, everybody's leaving. You could find some data to support that a little bit. Or the positive, hey, the church is doing okay. You could find some data there as well.
Yes, there's data for everyone.
Right.
Yes. I mean, I think that there is some positive data, for example, that our missionary force has rebounded to pre-COVID levels, which is great. Our conversion rate has rebounded to pre-COVID levels, which is great. But if you look at the long term, for example, if you're looking at conversion and missionary statistics stretching back 50 years, we are on a slow slide. It's not as dramatic as it has been for many other religions, and that's something that we can be grateful for. But it doesn't help anyone to deny the reality that this is a tough environment for religion. It's a tough environment for all religions. And I think that in our culture, we have this sense that we have to be presenting to the world that everything is awesome all the time and that we don't struggle. There are ways to emphasize positive things while also acknowledging, yes, people are leaving the church, and there are some legitimate reasons why people may be leaving the church. And those things are not necessarily mutually exclusive. The church can be succeeding in many areas that are beautiful areas, and also people are leaving the church.
You're listening to Access Utah. We've been talking with religious scholar Jana Reese. She gave the 2024 Arrington Mormon History Lecture at USU last week. Jana Reese is senior columnist for Religion News Service, prominent contributor to the Salt Lake Tribune. Her books include The Next Mormons, How Millennials Are Changing the LDS Church, and the comedic memoir Flunking Sainthood. And Jana Reese came to our studios last week ahead of her lecture. Our thanks to Jana Reese. Our thanks to you for listening to Access Utah.